of the Rosenfeld detector mode, which is the way it wakes up, and you can force it into the true sampling mode, in which it takes true 6 randomly selected in time samples and averages those. And now you see a very smooth-looking signal, but at least it has the right amount of logarithmically IF strip detected noise power. This is just one of many problems of dynamic range, display, statistics of display, and whatever you get into when it comes to making exact measurements of noise-like signals on a spectrum
repeater. Time out.
Making noise-like measurements on a spectrum analyzer. There's a lot more to it. I'm just showing you where we're beginning to scratch the surface. I may be a little bit off to one side, but Eric was going to give us some more information. KE2EJ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Hi. Let me give you this. By the way, most of the measurements that are done here are done with a 10 kilohertz resolution band, which gives you the shape of the signal, plus you'll get some nice little rounding of the pilots if you'll see it. But to measure and plot a signal is calculated in 10 kilohertz resolution bandwidth, calculate the total average power, and account for the resolution bandwidth overlap. The formula is 10 times log times the delta F, which is the difference in frequency, divided by 1.1 times the resolution bandwidth, where the delta frequency is equal to span, or the number of points, minus 1. And you use that to plot each point. Then you scale each point into the 500 kilohertz spacing, and then that's, of course, 10 times log, 500 kilohertz divided by 1.1 times the resolution bandwidth. And then, if you're actually looking for the subband comparison, you compare each point on a scaled signal to the rigid mass that the FCC requires. So, their way of looking at it, whether you're looking at the signal before their mass filter, and we're talking about at the transmitter side, you know, you're doing 18 megahertz worth of span to see what's happening on the left and right hand side, pass it through your mass filter, and ensure that you've got the splatter and the subband down. They don't really put a lot of emphasis on the pilot. They also recommend that if you're going to do, power measurement, first find out what the noise floor of your spectrum analyzer is, because the power measurement for DTB is going to be based on minus 110 dB as being the bottom. And when I get over to the right page, I can give you what the actual difference in level between the pilot and the actual signal is. K2RW, K2J.
I recognize that minus 110. I'll tell you why. Almost every standard spectrum analyzer for UHF and microwave work that you can buy has in the 1 megacycle resolution bandwidth mode noise on the screen that falls approximately at minus 80 dBm, which corresponds to something like a 33 dB noise figure. So the average spectrum analyzer has noise on the screen internally generated minus 80 dBm per megacycle, 33 decibel noise figure. When I go from a 1 meg filter to a 10 kilohertz filter, that's a 100 to 1 ratio I've changed. Therefore, there should be a 20 decibel difference in noise power, minus 80. Minus 80 and 20 dB of difference would be minus 100. Why minus 110? It suggests that there's a 10 decibel difference in the noise figure of the analyzer being discussed in that FCC report you're discussing versus the noise figure of the analyzers that I've worked with. Minus 110 is only a 23 dB noise figure analyzer instead of a 33. That's very different than the normal industry. I'm going to turn it back to you on that one, Eric. K2EJ, K2RIW.
Now, you got to remember that these methods are generalizations for the average, today's transmitter engineer to be able to deal with it. And it depends upon, whose manufacturer you're using. That's why what they want you to do is find out what the noise floor of the analyzer that you're using is. And you're going to make an offset and calculate from that down to minus 110, because that's where they consider the how you're going to create the value of what power things are happening at. The actual difference in, let's see, that's 0.6. The actual difference between the in-band DPV signal and the pilot, okay, according to this, is, I just lost the page, let me come back. Write this in plus one, in plus two, I'm sorry, I'm mumbling. Here it is. The pilot power of contribution, an 8 BSB signal is 0.3 of a dB. The peak average power ratio is 6.3 dB. You're not interested in that. You're not interested in that either. Yeah, they go into signal noise data, phase noise threshold, impulse noise threshold. This is on the part of performance at a receiver. Blah, blah, blah. Symbol rate. Actually, just to think about it, the symbol rate is actually 10.762238 megasymbols per second. The symbol... This will be helpful for you as far as, like, seeing those long periods of time. By the way, 12 miles is not unusual for reflection. Where is it? I just lost it again. Yeah, the segment time for...
Repeater, timeout.
The third generation equalizer range is from -3 to +22 microseconds. So what the gentleman from the NAB told you about the fifth generation equalizer is absolutely accurate. K2RW, K2J.
Okay, I'm getting the impression now that when it comes to making measurements, the standard you're looking at seems to have standard on a 10 kilohertz resolution bandwidth. Under those conditions, would there be something in the vicinity of 6 decibels of difference between the average broadband noise amplitude versus the pilot peak amplitude? Would it be in that ballpark, do you think, Eric? Go ahead.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's wiggle room here, too. They based their formula on the 10 kilohertz worth of bandwidth resolution, and everything that I've seen, everything that I've learned at this point, that's pretty much the reference point in terms of how to look at it and how to determine power. So, I think that's pretty fair in terms of going from instrument to instrument, that you can make that calculation. There's actually another calculation which will allow you to find the noise floor and add that to what the actual measurement is supposed to be. There's another formula for that where you terminate the input of your spectrum analyzer, find out what it says the noise floor is, and then you look for the magnitude of the power of the signal and subtract the difference between noise floor of the spectrum analyzer you're using and -110. So, and it's too many pages here. Every time I find something good, I just go right by it. And I don't want to dive into the actual formulas because it can get pretty heavy. K2RW, K2J.
Yeah, that thing you're just talking about right now, I've worked out the mathematics of that. It's nowhere near as bad as you think. I'll give you an example of what we're talking about. Let's assume now that I unplug the signal from the front end of the spectrum analyzer that I'm measuring and put a 50-ohm termination there. Let's assume that the noise is now sitting at -80 on the screen. I got a screen that goes from 0 dBm on the top of the screen and -100 dBm at the bottom. I get 10 vertical boxes on the screen, 10-centimeter screen. So my noise power is sitting at -80. I then plug in my signal, which is noisy, and in my particular example, let's assume now that the noise picked up by 3 decibels, went from -80 to -77 in the noisy areas when I plugged in the signal, the broadband noisy signal. Believe it or not, that situation equals the fact that the noise of the analyzer and the noise of the signal are equal to each other. Incoherent noises add in a power relationship. So if I got 2 sources of noise and they added together and I got a 3.01 dB increase, that means they're identical to each other. That means the -77 that I see on the screen has to be corrected by 3 dB, and the real noise power is minus 80 in my example. Now, as the number of decibels of increase on the screen gets louder and louder, like for instance if I had a 10 dB increase when I added the signal, that would mean something more like a half dB or so of correction is required. That means that the carrier to noise ratio, so to speak, the signal ratio of coming in versus the signal of the analyzer, one is 9.5 dB louder than the other, and you'll see a 10 dB increase when you add the two together. So there's a correction factor, a linear sliding correction factor, simple chunk of mathematics, and then we're working this one out, anti-logarithms, so that you can figure out what is the real noise power versus what you measure on the screen. That one's fairly easy. A slightly different question here, Eric, and that is, the Commerce Department ran out of money to give people these coupons that they've been requesting. Let me drop. In order to be able to get a $40 rebate on the digital converter they buy. Because the Commerce Department ran out of money, and they promised that the money would be there until March, but in the beginning of January they ran out of money, 2 months too soon. I'm hearing rumors that the Obama administration has said this is intolerable. We've made this promise to people. Therefore, the February 17th trade over date, Black Tuesday, in which we go from digital to analog, analog to digital, is going to be delayed. That he's making a request for that delay, and I'm hearing rumors that that delay is going to be as much as June. Now, he may be requesting that, and whether the Friendly Candy Company and Congress and whoever, the Commerce Department, are going to go along with that delay is something I'm asking you to make a speculation. Do you think it's likely or unlikely on a delay for the tradeover on February 17th? KE2EJ, K2LAW.
All right, on to politics, K2LAW, K2EJ. Let me go back here for a second. Just to give you a little more information, our spectrum analyzer is being noise-like input signals, all right? The point to remember here is that the Gaussian noise passes through the resolution bandwidth filter, which is the IF filter, the spectrum analyzer. The signal envelope is skewed and takes on Raleigh distribution. When you do envelope detection in a linear display after video filtering or trace averaging, the mean value is 1.253 theta. Then the analog is peak responding voltmeter calibrated to indicate RMS, which, you know, 0.707 times the peak of the sine wave, would turn 0.707 times 1.253 theta equal 0.866, which is 1.05 dB, or 20 times the log of 0.0866. Too low compared to the original theta of the RMS value of the Gaussian noise signal. It's not an ambiguous error, but it's a constant 1.05 dB. Alright. Anyway, going back to the politics, the bill has been put into Congress, it's been scribbled around a lot. The date is June 12th. The Republicans are now having, they're now screaming very loudly. And actually, if they do delay it, it's going to mess up an awful lot of stuff. Verizon and AT&T says they don't care one way or the other because they, you know, they want their spectrum. But think about all of the coordination that went into lining up TV stations that are going to be changing their channels, the manufacturers that have to do the installations and proof of performances have all been scheduled. So it's going to cost a lot of money if they move it, that's for sure. K2RIW, KE2J.
Fantastic. Give me a guess, Eric. Your gut feel. Is there a 10% change of a delay? A 50% change chance? Or a 90% chance of a delay? What's your gut feel as to the probability of that delay taking place with all of that impact that you just described?
Now, let's put it this way. It is estimated at this point now that there's over, 8 million households that are incapable of making the transition today to start with. The business about the coupons and the coupons that haven't been used, that money actually is there, but, you know, there hasn't been an accounting done of that at this stage of the game. From the political point of view, Obama doesn't want people have got all mad at him because of something that was already, you know, in place, because when the analogs go off and you don't have a converter, you ain't getting nothing. And that's going to be very hard for people who rely on the TV set that don't have cable and don't have satellite. And that does turn out to be a good chunk of voice in this country, and it has political implications. The triennial hard, chances are it might actually pass. But then again, you're going to have to wait until Monday, Tuesday, you know, tomorrow or the next day to see what actually happens. Oh, by the way, tonight at 3 a.m., 13, we'll be transmitting digital on VHF if you want to check it out. K2RW, K2J.
Okay, 3 o'clock in the morning tonight, from 3 o'clock to roughly 4 o'clock in the morning, roughly an hour's worth of digital transmission. And will that be a test pattern, or what will it be, Eric? Go ahead.
Ashley, it will probably be bars on the HD channel, but the KID channel and the Spanish channel will be going, so, you know, them will be playing what it normally plays, and 13 kids will be playing, so you'll be able to watch cartoons in Spanish, your bars, whatever you want.
This is going to go from channel, from 3 in the morning to 4 in the morning, approximately?
Yeah, that's approximately right. But what I got from Tom is that ABC is not going to participate tonight. It's just going to be him. And Channel 11 actually can't do it because of their physical hardware issues. So they're not going to test until they actually change over.
Now, this Channel 13 changeover, real Channel 13, you're not going to be doing that also. This discussion you and I were having earlier, was it today or yesterday, about can the type and adapters tolerate your transmit power. You're not going to be doing a digital changeover at the same time. Is that true?
Well, I mean, you know, comes to 17th. No, actually, probably by the end of next week, I hope, I will have all the hardware that I need. But to do an actual on-air test at 21, just to check out the mass filter, I'm going to have to do it. I mean, I could just boil water and call it a day. But I have found the stuff that I need to make the transition from the 3 1/8 to 6 1/8 inch pipe to go from 75 ohms to 50 ohms. That's what the discussion was. And actually, you clued me in on a few things. I went to the NAB handbook, and there it was on the formulas on how to do it. And so I'm actually waiting for a couple of pieces of pipe to come so I can complete this test. But I actually have to take where the analog is all plugged into the patch bay, and this is a 6 3/8 inch patch. It's a big plug. But, you know, I have to take out, like, 2 dozen bolts and take a whole bunch of sections of hardline and move that away and bring in the stuff that I'm going to use to test it out. So it's going to be interesting. I'm going to do it one night, but I'll probably take the station off the air for, like, 6 or 7 hours.
And you've ordered some copper pipes that you're going to be soldering together as the semiconductor that makes that transition? Is that approximately what's going to take place, Eric?
No, soldering 10 kilowatts is not a good idea. No, these things are mechanically bolted together. And then, of course, there's the bullets that make the connection between one pipe and the next.
A 10 kilowatts is easy to handle as long as the pipes are large enough in diameter with solder. So with solder, it's really a function of current density. If your pipe is large enough in diameter, and you're soldering together two pieces of pipe that are telescoping into each other, that could be a very safe joint, even at the 10 kilowatt level, it says here. But you know how to do that calculation. Hey, Joe, it looks like you're getting into some pretty interesting stuff here. And as you can tell, right now we don't have exact answers as to how many decibels above the noise should that pilot tone be. But I think what you're measuring is in the right ballpark. K2RYY, K2RYW in the TechNet.
Okay, I was simply measuring this stuff just to get an idea if a signal, at a specific signal level, well, now they know that I got to a point where I have the decoder, I can actually just start to decode the picture, and, you know, with like, I guess, Marshall breakup, I guess if I call out my threshold, I'll know at least at that point, anything above that by 10 or 20 decibels, that's, you know, I guess I could hold out my head and once I get everything, you know, actually put up. Being that I'm actually measuring all this stuff off a monitor antenna, I don't have the actual television antenna up on the roof yet because of the outside weather conditions and so forth, but that's coming very soon. I have all my hardware It just needs a little warmer weather to be able to get that done and be able to actually see what I'm going to end up with for a real type of installation. So that's the way I'm asking these questions about this type of thing. It's like a measure ahead of time and get an idea about what I'm doing. By the way, do you happen to have a your own decoder box to decode digital television?
No, let me throw something in there.
Go ahead, Eric.
In terms of if you're measuring threshold for your converter box, do not use channel 4, which is 28, do not use 56, which is 2, do not use 45, which is ABC, do not use 38 and 33. If you're going to make those measurements, use 22, use 44, which is Fox, because those stations that I just told you about, all running at a deficit. They're creating their own problems and their own interference. So, to make a long story short, don't use the stuff coming off Empire unless you want to dial up Fox or Channel 25, which is actually 24, which comes from Four Times Square, or you can use 22, which is nice because the stuff coming off of Empire, or like 2, 4, 7, 9, 11, they all have damaged it. It's damaged transmission. They're actually making your receiver work really hard for no good reason. And it's not a good way to measure the threshold of sensitivity of the converter box or receiver, because it's not a good signal to start with. Work with something that's clean if you want to know what the converter's actually doing.
Well, I was using digital channel 22, your favorite, and that was a fairly consistent signal, and by doing so, that's what I used as a source, and I was attenuating it down. And like I said earlier, I checked the next channel up and found a difference of about 8 to 10 dB. That signal was stronger than your digital channel 22, but it still made the block clock break up occasionally. But what I also noticed by looking on an analyzer is a lot of times that signal on 23 was not a flat signal across the screen. A lot of times the center of it would dip down quite a bit, like I was getting multipath or some sort of change in amplitude with the signal level from your signal coming into my antenna was relatively flat across most of the 6 meg that I was looking at.
Hey, give us a couple of words, Eric. The ones that you recommend we don't use, that you said they're damaged signals, is this a temporary condition? Is it an intentional modification to the signal for some kind of a testing purpose? Or is it, what do you mean by damaged signals that we shouldn't use? What is wrong with them? Wrong ratio? Wrong delays? K2EJ, K2RIW?
All right, K2RIW, K2EJ. To make a long story short, right, when they first, they had on Empire, the UHF antennas, they had four panels. One, just for the sake of it, it's not exactly north, east, west, and south, but let's just say that it's north, east, west, and south. The south-facing panel was reflecting on itself, so they decided that they had flown around it with a helicopter and found that, you know, there was a big null heading south because of the reflection from the back of the panel banging up against the building and, in essence, canceling itself. So they decided to rearrange the antenna arrangement, and what they did was they put in what they called, they took away the south antenna and put on the 84th floor something they called the backfill antenna to cover, you know, Brooklyn and Staten Island. And the way it got piped up, the propagation delay or the delays from the transmitter to the antenna are no longer equal. So basically, what they're doing is they're transmitting a signal that has built-in multipath, and it makes the receivers nuts. They did a test, it wasn't a test, they had to do some work, so they shut that antenna off, and I did a test, and I went from measurements that I made, which would normally, okay, normally, let's just for the sake of it, I'm not going to explain what the numbers are, but I'll give you numbers. Channel 2 would normally come in with an EBM, let's call it a signal noise, of 36 dB, right? And when that backfill antenna is on, the signal noise drops down to about 2726. So you can see the difference or the damage that they're doing to the signal. They drop. So their concept is the 17th is coming around. I mean, we don't care, because after the 17th, what we're going to be doing is we're going to be putting the new UHF stuff on the top, which will be, you know, a perfect 360-degree radiator up there. They're not going to have any of those issues. So they're basically, you know, we did what we wanted. We flew around it with another helicopter. We found out we got the radiation pattern that we need. So we're done. Except that they forgot about that point. And they, in essence, make their own multi-pair that only affects people to the east and to the southeast. I have a receiving point out west and a receiving point out in the southwest, and whether that backfill antenna is on or off has no effect. I've got people in Smithtown, when the backfill antenna is on, they can't receive nothing. When the backfill antenna goes off, they get plenty of pictures. KQRWK2GA.
The delta on that backfill antenna, what's your guess in nanoseconds, Eric?
Now, I think about 3 weeks ago we talked about this. We figured it's got to be a difference of about 300 feet in pipe. Because what Dielectric did was they took the output waveguide, put a dimensional coupler on it, and used that as a tap-off, and then ran another piece of pipe to the antenna that's on the fourth floor as opposed to the antenna that's up on the mooring mast. And there's no way in heck that anybody put the thought, though, maybe we should have the same amount of feed line between the two places, and, well, that's the result.
I think you said 85 nanoseconds or 85 feet of a pipe, or was it 75 feet of pipe, some number like that?
I don't remember the exact numbers. I think it's like 400 feet of pipe to get to the top, and probably only around 100 feet of pipe to get to the to what we call the backfill antenna.
Are you saying 300 feet of pipe difference? That's what it sounds like, a difference of 300 feet of pipe.
Yeah, I suspect it's in that range. From 200 to 300 feet, I think there's a difference of about that much. It may even be more, because the distance between the where the combiner is on the 86th floor and the bottom of the antenna where they feed it is really not that far. I'd be surprised if it's actually 100 feet.
That's a lot of nanoseconds, though. And I think you're saying that the average third-generation converter box is going to have a fair amount of grief with that. Is that one way of putting it?
Yeah, actually, a third-generation converter box has so much grief that it, in a lot of cases it won't decode the pictures on a specific channel because it is frequency selective. Some are worse than others. And a fifth-generation box has a pretty hard time with it, but you wouldn't know it because you're getting nice pictures.
The people who suffer the most, is it us to the east and west because we get half of the south signal along with the east-facing signal, therefore we're getting the maximum ratio, whereas the guys to the south, in theory, are only seeing the south antenna, and although they're getting a signal that's advanced by 300 feet, it probably is not giving them any grief because of the ratio. Am I approximately right on this one, Eric?
Well, I don't know anybody in Staten Island, but I know a lot of people in Brooklyn, and I let them know when they turned off the backfill antenna. A lot of them have, some of them have third-generation receivers and couldn't get a couple of the channel. When they turned the backfill antenna off, all the numbers on the receivers started to go up, even though they probably had less signal strength.
Okay. So these are some of the growing pains of this system. And I think you did or did not make a guess as to whether or not the delay till June is likely or unlikely. Give me that guess one more time, Eric.
Well, you'll probably have an answer in another couple of days, to be quite honest. The new administration would like to see it happen. They do have a majority in Congress, so, I mean, if the Democrats got their act together, then, yeah, they could pass it. It could happen. it was looking very much like it was going to happen. But a bunch of Republicans have now gotten up and said, hold your horses. But there were other people who had bought Spectrum who said, you know, it doesn't bother us, so if you want to do it, go right ahead. So we're just going to have to see who wins.
Okay, the next couple of days we'll know. And maybe Black Tuesday of February 17th will not be Black Tuesday. Any final comments, Joe, before we go on to the next questioner, and then maybe we can come back to you. WHYYY, HYYW.
Yeah, I had one other question concerning the subject. I've also noticed a channel, I am seeing a digital signal on channel 10, but my decoder cannot and never has locked up on it, but I can see a carrier with a pilot type of signal on what is on VHF channel 10. Do you happen to know where that's coming from, Eric?
Alright, are you using a directional antenna?
No, all the tests I've been doing so far is with an omnidirectional vertically polarized antenna. I do not have a correct television antenna installed on the roof yet because of the weather.
Where are you located?
Sayville.
Alright. Let me tell you that when we test transmitters, we generally use a random number generator to simulate data, and it looks just like a perfect signal, but you don't get anything on your receiver, so a lot of guys, while they're putting their transmitters together, I know there's a channel 10 up in, I think it's Bridgeport, and they've been testing and on the air and stuff like that. That's probably what you're seeing.
Yeah, okay, right. The converter, the signal level actually hunts up and down, but it never ever locks up on the signal. There's just nothing ever there. I can get channel 2, which is, I guess, 57 or 56. I get that all the time. Channels 5 and 7 I get occasionally, which is channel, 44 and 45, something like that. They come and go as far as signal level, so I'm not really depending on those all the time, but that's what I've been missing so far. And my other question for Dick is, do you have one of these converter boxes yourself? Have you ever gotten one of these DTV converter boxes?
Yes, I do have a converter box. No, it is not hooked up. My UHF TV antenna has experienced some damage, and because of the weather, I haven't fixed it yet. So I've got the box, but nothing to connect to it. Joe, go ahead.
Okay, because I would have thought you would be very, very interested in seeing how much kind of television DX, so to speak, from your location you could actually pull in, because I'm sure you'd be able to get a lot of stuff way up north in Connecticut and so forth.
Yeah, before my rotator failed on the yard arm on the side of one of my towers, I had a UHF antenna mounted 80 feet above the ground, and it was steerable. And boy, could I do some UHF television DXing in the old days. But the converter failed and the antenna disconnected. Quite nice, in good shape. It yanked itself off of the cable, and quite a bit of repair is required. I also had that was a corner reflector type, bow tie corner reflector. I also have a 5-foot dish at that exact same level, but again, it's not operational and needs repair. Okay, the next person who signed in was Steve with a question, if I didn't skip anybody, and I think that's true. Steve, KC2MDT, Mike, Delta Tango, I think it is. Are you still there, Steve? K2LIW in the TechNet.
Yes, I am, Dick. Mike, Delta Papa. Good evening to you. Good evening to Mel. My question, and everyone else on the net, sorry. My question is about, DirecTV and Dish Network satellite systems. I recently scavenged in a Dish Network, and not a Dish Network, DirecTV satellite antenna. And my system I'm using right now is Dish Network, which has got the dual LND, and, you know, it's skewed 127 degrees and, you know, points to the southwest. I picked up this antenna, which is a DirecTV antenna, and this thing is like 20 by 36. I took a single LND, and I stuck it in there to see if I could get a signal. Sure enough, I get a signal. I got the thing to lock up after a couple of minutes, I'd lose the lockup, but I'd still have a satellite signal. My question basically is, you know, what's going on here? You know, we would stay locked up for like two or three minutes, and all of a sudden I'd lose the lock on the satellite receiver. It would tell me wrong satellite, and I'd still have a signal. You know, nothing got moved, dish didn't get moved, anything else like that. Your opinion on that, Dick. Back to you.
Yeah, run this by again. 20 by 36, is that inches? The normal DirecTV dish is 18 inches in diameter with an offset feed. The dish network, the one with the dual feed, I guess is the one you're describing, that's 20 by 36. 20 high, 36 wide. And how did you go about aiming it with those two feed ones? Over to you, Steve.
Okay, Dick, I'll give you a little further info. The dish network dish is dual feed, and I think it's either 19 or 20 inches elliptical. The antenna I picked up, I scavenged, is 20 high by about 36 wide, and it came with, supposedly looked on the internet, it says it's got 5 LNDs in it. I would imagine, I think it's a for high def TV. Basically, I took a single LND that I had laying around. I shoved it in the front of this thing. I get the signal to lock up on the dish network, you know. Everything would be fine for the one satellite. After a couple of minutes, I'd lose the lock, but I'd still have a, basically a satellite signal on the meter they give you on this receiver. Back to you.
Okay, when you buy that service, they give you a card, and that card becomes authorized. Does your receiver have the appropriate card for a service that you've paid for, or is it possible you're running into a situation where the card not being the right one only lets you watch it for a given length of time before it blanks things out? And that's question number one. And question number two, how did you go about aiming the dish to pick up on the appropriate signal? Over to you, Steve.
Okay, yes, this is a working dish. It has an authorized card in it. As far as aiming the dish, I took a big piece of plywood I had laying around, staked it into the ground, mounted the dish on top of it. I got one of them little cheapo satellite signal meters. I peeked up on that, then I'd go inside, see if I had a signal lock and, you know, what the signal strength was. I'd go out, I'd play with it a little more to get the peak signal. And, you know, after a couple of minutes, you'd lose the signal lock, but meanwhile, the satellite strength was still there. Back to you.
Okay, after a couple of minutes, you lose the lock on the satellite. Is that a repetitive operation? Every time you turn it on, it works for a period of time and then loses lock? What do you do to repeat the process, Steve? Go ahead.
Okay, sometimes you turn the receiver off, it'll reset itself after a couple of minutes. Other times you just can go through the menu and get out of that, aim your dish menu, go into something else, come back to it, and, you know, after a couple of minutes it'll lock back up. Back to you.
But I think you're saying when it locks up, it never stays locked for more than a few minutes and then jumps out of lock? And if you just let it sit there, does it ever come back on its own? Over to you, Steve.
Well, I let it sit for a good 10, 15 minutes, I'd say, and no, it would not come back.
He's looking at the wrong satellite.
Yeah, give us some words on this one, Eric.
Now, if he's using that Echo Star, you're looking at 101 degrees or 110 degrees?
I think the one I'm looking at is 119, I do believe. But the funny thing is, like I said, I get a lock, and, you know, after a few minutes, it would jump out a lock. That was my first impression that, you know, this dish is way bigger, and, you know, I'm picking up another satellite. But then again, I'm saying to myself, the two EchoStar satellites, the dish network, are supposed to be basically on top of each other. So how does it discern from one to the other? Back to you.
No, actually, EchoStar has a whole bunch of satellites. You look at some of the EchoStar dishes, you'll see some that look like they're pointed 90 degrees away from each other. Actually, the one at 119 is shared between DirecTV and EchoStar. There's another one at 117 that's neither. You got to remember the way EchoStar does this stuff. Their data cycle, I think, is like 10 minutes long or 6 minutes long. So the receiver expects to get a blast of data every 6 minutes, every 10 minutes. If it doesn't see it, it just shuts down.
In that case, Eric, what can he do to correct the condition?
Well, let's put it this way. If it's not the LMB being intermittent, and there's a lot of different kinds of problems you can have with that, probably he needs to look at which satellites next to each other and make sure you point it to the right one. I mean, they make these inclinometers that are fairly accurate. You know, it's still a visual thing. You use the tick marks on your dish to try and get it. I always use a spectrum analyzer. It's so easy to see, and I bring a list of what satellites are where, and you can pretty much identify them and then pick up on it instead of using the receiver, because that kind of just makes you crazy.
I wonder if he's running into a problem I remember seeing a couple of years ago, and that is there were certain educational direct television, direct satellite services you could subscribe to. However, they required a low noise block feed, which had a much higher stability of its local oscillator. Some kind of a crazy digital transmission or whatever was taking place, and that the ordinary LMB wouldn't hack it. You had to buy the special LMB with a higher stability of its LO. Is there any possibility he's running into anything like that? Over to you, Eric.
Yeah, it could be. The older stuff, in the case of what you're talking about, C-band, you had an LMB with a certain noise figure, which was fine for analog, but once you got to doing QPSKs, which comes down to the satellite, impulse noise, natural noise of the LMB becomes a problem. Because it really doesn't have any error correction in satellite, as opposed to the terrestrial stuff. That's why we have Trellis and all those other things. Yeah, there's the Viterbi is there, and also the, what they call in and out of correction for MPEG is there. But they really don't go into correcting transmission at the RF link level. Whereas the terrestrial transmission, HD radio, direct to, digital television over the air, even Radio Mondale has some form of trellis or error correction on the RF portion of the signal.
So, Eric, would you recommend that Steve try one of his LNBs? In other words, try changing which low noise block feed he uses, just in case the one he's got has some something going on with its stability of its local oscillator. Over to you, Eric.
Well, if you're talking about EchoStar or DirecTV, the method of transmission hasn't changed since they started, so if you've got an LNB that was originally on EchoStar, it should work fine if there's nothing wrong with it.
KC2QIQ.
Go ahead, Glenn.
Yeah, I had DirecTV for years, Dick, and I set up a couple of them on my own in a couple of different locations, everywhere from Florida up to here in New York. And the message that he's getting just means that he's got a bad signal. Now, I mean, it could be a couple of things. It could be the coax. You know, you have to use, at minimum, the RG6U. Make sure the cable's in really, really good shape. The connectors are in really good shape on both ends. Try to keep the length from between the LNB and the dish to the receiver under 100 feet if you can. It's not super critical if you use an RG6, but that's something to keep in mind. Make sure the cable's brand new and good connectors on either end. The other thing, too, is it can also be positioning of the dish and make sure that it's up high enough and out of the way from any obstructions. But usually once you hit it and you lock it on and you've got good cable, I really doubt. Usually if you start having problems with an LNB or a receiver, it's just down for the count and it doesn't come back. But I would suggest more than likely it's just either bad cable or poor dish positioning or bad location. KC2QIQ.
Very fine, Glenn. Steve, one of the things that's not very well known is that where the dish is looking in the sky, that whole swamp of sky has to be nothing but clear blue sky. If you're looking through a couple of leaves of a tree, that's in the corner of that beam coming out of your dish going up to the sky, if it's looking at some leaves of a tree or branches of a tree, it'll pick up the black body noise of those things, because that dish is very cryogenic. That KU band dish is running a small fraction of one decibel of noise figure, you know, something like 30 degrees Kelvin, and that tree branch that's in the way, you think it's transparent, but it's a 300 degree Kelvin device sitting there cranking out broadband noise, which hurts signal-to-noise ratio. So even though you may be getting enough signal strength according to your signal strength meter, you might not be getting the right carrier-to-noise ratio. So do you think your dish is looking at pure blue sky, Steve? KC2MDP, K2LAW, and the TechMan.
Yes, Dick, it is definitely looking at clear blue sky. That, you know, you brought up, I think Eric brought up another good question there. Do you think maybe because this is a dual LND dish and I'm only running a single that basically the receiver's not seeing the information it should be and is locking up? That's question one. And question number two, is there a difference between the Dish Network LND and the DirecTV LND? Because the one I'm using is a DirecTV LNB, and it is brand new, basically. It's brand new, been sitting in the basement for probably 10 years. Back to you, Dick.
I said, see if Eric's got an opinion on that one.
Actually, yeah, there's a difference in terms of the frequency coverage. The oscillators are different by, I don't remember, it's a few megahertz. But you essentially can use them. This network is on 110 and 119. You could be mistakenly, because this is a dual LMB dish, you got to remember, if you want to know exactly where the dish is pointing, that's only a small quadrant to the spheroid. So imagine the whole thing being a ball, and it's shifted around where the LMB is, and you know the actual direction in which it's coming from. But if you have a dual LMB and you've got one LMB on one side and one on the other, there's probably like 9 degrees difference between the two of them. So you could in fact be looking at the wrong satellite.
Any further comments on that one, Steve?
Yeah, what I will do is, you know, when I get a little ambition, I'll have to take the dual LMB off the dish I'm using now and give it a shot. Family won't be too thrilled, but, you know, all in the name of science. Back to you, Dick.
Let me just let you know that if you're supposed to be looking at 119, if you're off a little bit one direction, you'll see that at 119 is Echo Star 7 is what you want to be looking at. At 121 is Echo Star 9. And at 116 is SatMex 5, which is a DBS satellite. So it would make your receiver see a signal. And until it'll actually decode until it expects to see that burst of data and then shut itself off.
What's the reason it shuts itself off if it doesn't see a burst of data? Is that burst of data some kind of an authorization code, Eric, go ahead?
Yeah, it's actually the data that the card looks at and says, oh, this belongs to me. Okay.
KC2QAQ.
Go ahead, Glenn.
His original question, if he has the wrong LNB, he'll get nothing. It won't ever turn on. It'll just be blank and he'll get an error. You know, there will be absolutely no signal whatsoever if he's got the wrong LNB. So the fact that he's turning it on, getting an LNB, you know, getting a signal, and he's seeing a picture and getting audio, that means he's got the right LNB. The fact that it's 2 or 1 makes no difference at all in terms of whatever. It's just positioning of the dish or a bad cable, one or the other. It's just he's got a low signal condition. It's very, very typical of what happens with low signal. Just bad cable or not pointed in the right direction. KC2QIQ.
I had the impression of what you were telling us, Steve, that when you go through the alignment procedure, you'll always get 6 minutes or so of operation and then it drops out. So Eric's speculation that you're not getting that burst of data from the other bird maybe is what's going on. Is there a way you could hook it up the way the converter wants to see two birds at once? Over to you, Steve.
You know, the way you can know if you're looking at 119 is the NASA public channel is there. There's no encryption on it. So if you can pick up NASA, and it should stay because it doesn't care whether it sees the data or not.
What transponder number is NASA? Select Eric, go ahead.
Now, if you want to know what the transponder is, I can tell you, but it It's done by channel numbers, which is mapped, and that map is constantly sent in the data. So if it's supposed to be on channel 262 on one receiver, it's actually on transponder 11, but on transponder 11 is about a dozen stations, so it's you just have to know what the map number is.
Are those dozen stations frequency division multiplex through that bent pipe, or is there some kind of a digital CDMA-like function going on? Go ahead.
Oh, it's the same thing as digital television. There's a bunch of, the transponder is, in this case, is 18 megahertz wide. In a 6 megahertz slot, they put four standard definition signals. Because don't forget, they don't have the trellis, they don't have the other stuff, so a single 6 megahertz chunk gives them about 36 megabits worth of signal. And in 36 megabits worth of signal, if you're going to do a standard SD, okay, that runs at about 3 megabits apiece, 3.5 megabits apiece on satellite, divide 3 into 36, and that's the number of channels you can get there.
Sounds good. Anyone with any further comments on all of the above, give me your call letters right now. K2RAW and TechNet. Okay, there being none, as you do those experiments, Steve, please come back and let us know how it turns out. Again, I was using a 18-inch DirecTV dish a year or two ago. That also needs repair. My system is falling apart. I think we've gone down all of the people who signed in who had a question. If not, give me your call letters right now if I skipped anybody by mistake. Looks like I didn't skip anybody. Mel, we've got some more time for the mailbag tonight. You've got 2 hours. We can almost catch you up. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Okay, this is K2KEY. Very good. All right, a few weeks ago, if you remember, there was a question asked about using a TVB. Basically terminated VB. And what's it all about? Well, it sort of attracted me. What is it all about? Hearing something I wasn't familiar with. So I did some research on to find out what a TVB is, Dick. Over.
Let's hear about that. Is it an inverted B with dummy loads? What actually is it, Mel? Go ahead.
As it's described, it was originated by a Dr. Jose A. Valadares, V-A-L-L-A-D-A-R-E-S, who has a Ph.D. in the 80s. He was an antenna, they said, an antenna guru who introduced to the TVB system in 1961. When he installed several of them at commercial HF receiving stations, the TVB one day was a pre-satellite type of installation, and they described the antenna. Did you ever hear of this Dr. Valadares, Dick? Did you know of any of his works? Over.
I'm going to get my copy of Volakis, which I've got sitting on the bookshelf, while you're talking, and I'm going to look up the author index and see if he's there. But I'm not familiar with that name right now. But I'm not a big wire man when it comes to wire antennas. I'm more into the horns and aperture type UHF and SHF antennas. Go ahead.
Very good. Well, anyhow, it seems that this antenna, there's the length of the radiating element. It can be as many several wavelengths long. The diameter of a radiating element, you can improve bandwidth by using more than one wire or a cage configuration. The angle formed by the two wires, apex angle, the value of the non-inductive terminating resistance, the height of the feed borne above ground, the height of the terminating resistance above ground,
and the length of the wire that connects the two terminating resistors, sometimes not used by vehicles, but found to be very useful in proving radiation patterns. All right, so he lays out an antenna here for, basically for 6 meters, Dick, which is pretty straightforward, but I guess we'd have to really give it a try before I can say whether it's a great idea or maybe something that has already been done, but it doesn't look too familiar with for me, over.
I just barely got back from my bookshelf with the handy talkie in hand so I could hear you. I'm about to start looking him up in the book right now, Mel. So those kind of bandwidth cells sound awful good. And give me the spelling of that last name again.
Okay, it's B-A-L-L-A-D-A-R-E-S. Jose A. Lazarus, or Lazarus, you don't know how it's Spanish name, but I guess it's pronounced Valadari, Dick, over.
Okay, I'm looking up the index right now. You go ahead and proceed with either that or the next question, and I'll let you know if I find something.
Okay, well, give a brief description here of antenna that for practical use,